Welcome back to the IWRA's podcast series, Wales, A Work in Progress, which seeks to examine and inform the ongoing debate around Wales's constitutional and democratic future. Today, we've got a really fascinating discussion lined up, delving into questions of dialogue, deliberation, and democratic renewal. In Wales, we've all heard of new methods of democracy being used in specific projects, from citizens' assemblies to participatory budgeting pilots. But what do these projects aim to achieve, and what direction do they point for the future of our politics and what it means to truly involve citizens in the decisions which affect their everyday lives? To do this, I'm glad to say we've got two specialists in this area in Wales to help us draw out these questions. I'm joined by Dr. Jennifer Wallowick, who is Principal Lead of Aberystwyth University's Dialogue Centre. We'll dive into what this works on and is aiming to achieve shortly, having joined from Simon Fraser University's Centre for Dialogue and Public Square in Vancouver, Canada. Croeso, Jen.
Thank you.
Joining us too is Dr. Anwyn Elias of Aberystwyth University. Anwyn's co-director of the Centre for Welsh Politics and Society and the Wales Institute of Social and Economic Data and Research, WISED, and a commissioner on the Independent Commission on the Constitutional Future of Wales. Anwyn's also an honorary fellow of the IWRA. Croeso, Anwyn.
Hello, Shumai.
Thank you, both of you, very much indeed for coming along to speak with us. So, Jen, I'm going to start with you, please. Could you just talk us through your work in setting up the Dialogue Centre, what it is, what it's been doing, where is it going, and what are you trying to achieve?
Yes, thank you. As you can tell, I am, you know, not from Wales, but I've been here for about 6 months now. So our Dialogue Centre is a new endeavour for Aberystwyth University, and it's been established to support the university's pursuit of knowledge exchange. So for knowledge exchange to work well, researchers, business, third, private and public sector folks need to be in rooms together having back and forth dialogue. And often we think of knowledge exchange, it's a good intention, but often it's more like knowledge transfer. So a researcher publishes something, or imagine a researcher at the front of the room giving a presentation with some Q&A. That's helpful, but by introducing this notion of dialogue, we're trying to change the structure of the conversation for more innovative collaborations. So I want to give you an example, and then I'll talk about our aspirations. So this spring at the Senate, we were in that lobby space, which is lovely and amazing. That building's fantastic. And instead of asking our researchers to come and give presentations, we sat them down at tables. We had six tables, and we surrounded them by members of the third sector and those with lived experience in the pursuit of asylum seekers and migration. So in Wales's aspirations for to be a nation of sanctuary, we wanted folks to shape these questions together. And so we gave them questions to discuss as a group, and the researchers shared their research as a piece of this conversation, but they also got to hear directly from folks who are trying to implement solutions on the ground and those who've been through the procedures and policies. And what we found out was that A, the participants really felt more respected and they really appreciated telling stories on an equal level, as well as, you know, you can hear in these conversations that emails are being exchanged, plans are being hatched, people are buying in or building skepticism together. And then afterwards, the researchers are making a commitment to come back and have further conversations. So it's about this cycle in that space. So our aspirations is to kind of help Aberystwyth researchers be known as folks who do their work with empathy, accountability, a prioritization of relationship building, and really seeking, like, how does our research help folks achieve impact? And all that requires these kind of personal and facilitated skills of dialogue that I know you're going to ask me about later.
And that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask you about unpicking some of the difference between deliberation and dialogue, please, Jen.
Yeah, so Oliver Escobar of Edinburgh University actually has a fantastic report on this. It was part of his work as a beacon of engagement. And so he's unpicked for us theory, linguistics, and what these two things meet. And so when I meet with folks, I talk about debate and dialogue first. So debate is a team sport. It's something that has sides. You can look at the House of Commons. It's a physical example. And you are actually in that space with some social norms. The social norms are usually that you're listening to kind of hear what's wrong. You're listening in order to form your argument, to fill in the gaps. And its Latin origins actually have a meaning associated with beating down the other. So it's a competitive atmosphere. A dialogue I like to explain, and many others do, as a circle. So each person contributes their lived experience, opinions, and knowledge into the center of the conversation. It emphasizes social norms of curiosity and intentionally pausing your judgment. So instead of listening for what's wrong or a no but, you have a mindset of a yes and. You're listening to figure out why what you're hearing makes sense to the speaker. And then how do you add to that with your own story? Its Latin origins are about meanings built across things. It's a flow of meanings. So those two things are certain mindsets that we can use when we enter deliberation. Deliberation is the process of weighing pros and cons and finding compromise. What are our recommendations? What are our actions? If you enter deliberation with a mindset of debate, you'll often feel like you're losing out on something. If you enter it with a mindset of dialogue, you tend to acknowledge complexity more often. You tend to spend time thinking about underlying values and how your opinions might affect others in reality. So we host these processes. This is the facilitated point of dialogue to help people generate sort of what are all the options on the table, explore that, explore really why do I hold the opinions I have and why does that person hold the opinions they have. Then we ask people to introduce some judgment and enter into that deliberation space. Let's narrow down our options. But now that we've known each other as human beings, it makes that process people are more likely to change their mind, to accept compromise, and then also come up with kind of that interesting third option that might not have been on the table at the beginning of that process. So it's really about the social norms in which you do deliberation.
I think we might come back into sort of the comparison between, for instance, the House of Commons and the Senate is interesting then, isn't it, in terms of that physical space and how it's used. But I might come back to you in a minute and ask you where you see that sort of dialogue happening well in spaces that people might already be aware of. But first, I want to come to you, Anwen, around, you know, we've got this massive conversation around Wales's constitutional future and taking that into a space that's meaningful to everyday people's lives and people's everyday lives as well. Because most people don't wake up morning, noon and night and think, ooh, let's hash through what the future options of Wales are from a constitutional geekery perspective. When there's so much going on, particularly given the cost of living crisis at the moment, how are we doing that? And are we doing that well enough?
I'll speak here from the perspective of the Independent Commission on Wales's constitutional future, because one of the tasks given to that commission was to have a national conversation with the people of Wales about how Wales is governed. You are right. Unfortunately, people don't think about this question very often, nor are they really interested in this question. So it's been quite a challenge thinking how we do that. And part of our thinking has very much been that we do need to get out to talk to people where they are, rather than just expecting people to come to us where we hold events or in the platforms that we provide for, you know, online surveys, for example. So we've tried to do that in several ways. Firstly, we've worked with community organisations to give them the opportunity to tell us what they would like to do, which makes sense for the people that they engage with, and which would be an appropriate way of talking to their communities about these issues. We've also run sessions in events such as the Royal Welsh, the Eisteddfod, again, where people hang out anyway. So going to where people are. The other really important thing is that you talk about these things in a way which avoids the really complex, boring language of constitutions and governance and that kind of thing. So we've spent quite a lot of time thinking very carefully about how do we ask these questions in a way that does make sense for people's everyday lives. Because what we found is that, okay, people don't think about constitutional issues, but they do think a lot about issues like, can I get an appointment to see my doctor? Or can I pay my mortgage? Or how much is my weekly shop going to cost me? Our approach is to say, well, you know, underpinning these immediate challenges that you are facing are constitutional questions, because a lot of these things are to do with who takes what decisions on what issues at what level of government. So by thinking quite carefully about, you know, how we raise these questions and how we phrase them and how we link them into the things that do matter to people, people do have an opinion almost always, and they do have thoughts about how wills should be governed. So it's this combination of, you know, where do we go to talk to people and how do we talk to people in ways which are meaningful to them?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And let's unpick a little bit of that, because I don't think personally that the constitutional stuff is boring. I think once you get into it, it's fundamental in terms of how things work, because it lays the foundation for all the sorts of things that you've been talking around who gets to choose what, where the options are in terms of how things work and what that means for people's everyday life. But they don't normally see the traces of the lines that connect these things up. When you start unpeeling that, people absolutely don't. It's not that they don't want to know. Our experience at the IWRA is absolutely they do want to know. They just don't know what the building blocks are and how they can be moved around. So there's some issues here in terms of democracy more broadly, which obviously is a different thing to our kind of constitutional setup and arrangements. But in terms of where democracy is in Wales, Jen, you've got the advantage of a kind of relative newcomer's bird's eye view from that perspective. So we'll just eat that out a little bit longer, because your feet are clearly under the table and you're flying here. I'm mixing my metaphors. But where do you see these sorts of conversations around democracy fitting into that global picture of the erosion of democratic norms in terms of people's engagement with the processes of democracy? Mm-hmm.
I am going to embrace one of my own values of dialogue and admit I don't know a lot at the moment. I'm still new to Wales. I'm in a lot of listening. So I'm actually going to invite Ariel, as someone who's been at many of these tables, to also answer this question, as well as you, Anwen. But I do think we have that similar OECD report around erosions of trust in institutions. I sense that. I also sense, you know, this beautiful IWA roundtable that we were at, which talked about low participation in elections, the need for education that, as Anwen just pointed out, starts with where people are at and then explains how elections work and why these building blocks matter, rather than saying, you know, this is this big scary word democracy and here's how it works. As one of the spaces. And I think folks are starting to do that work. Many folks at that roundtable were talking about there is curriculum. The challenge is helping teachers feel really comfortable delivering that curriculum. But I also think there's some fantastic foundations in Wales. And it's part of why I moved across the world. So we have incredibly strong farming communities who've saved languages and culture. The arts community, Anwen didn't mention, but the work that they did with the Constitution of Futures and Dialogue was done around collages. It was done around asking photography clubs to take photographs that shared metaphors of what it means for Wales's future. And having seen those photographs, they make you think. And the Future Generation Act, it's really asking us to be better. But it's going to take some time to implement in practice. You know, we do write laws, and then it takes public servants and all the rest of us to figure out, okay, what does this look like in practice? And we're in that space right now. But its ways of working priorities are incredibly inspiring. But I look at those ways of working, not just as what public servants should do, but also asking all of us to think about how do we shift our own practices? So how can we all be involved? How can we all collaborate? How do we get out of the habit of thinking about the here and now and think about the long term? How do we acknowledge complexity and integration and put the energy towards difficult choices of prevention? So those five ways of working are incredibly valuable principles for Wales's democracy. And I think it can actually be used as a leader and a leadership role for the world.
Thank you. Thanks, Jen. Anwen, you know, thinking about what Jen was talking about in terms of erosion of trust and things, are there particular points you want to draw out that the Commission is thinking is connecting to? Because you've got this view of sort of what's going on in Wales, the good stuff that Jen's just been setting out, but also the significant challenges we have where people may not see reason for engaging because nothing ever changes.
Yes, very much. And I think that's a clear theme that has come back to us when we have talked to citizens about our work. There is a common response we get is, I don't know anything about politics, and I'm not really interested in politics. And that certainly feeds into, feeding into that is a sense of disconnect from politics, from politicians, from institutions of government. What's interesting, though, is when you start digging into that, what does that mean? You don't know anything about politics. Actually, people often know more than they perhaps think they do. And certainly they often have views about political issues. Rather, what they don't have perhaps is maybe the confidence to talk about those, maybe the vocabulary to talk about those things, and often also the opportunities to talk about those things. So, yes, I see very much this lack of knowledge or understanding, this disconnect, maybe this lack of trust in politics. But I'm not entirely pessimistic. I think underneath there is actually potential. People are interested. When they're given the chance, they do really want to talk about these things. They do think these things are important to talk about. And in our work, when we have talked to them about, the way Wales is run, how should it be run, what kind of democracy should we aspire to, people really get going with these conversations. Yes, there are challenges there, but I think there's also potential there. The question, of course, is how do we tap into that? How do we mobilise that potential for democratic engagement, which maybe isn't there?
So let's look at some of those examples internationally in terms of embedding that sort of deliberative democratic suite of methods, because that's part of that exploratory, well, how about if kind of process, isn't it, Jen? Can you share from your experience, maybe from your previous roles, what you've either been involved in or what you've seen that was, oh, there's something interesting here? That, I mean, it's not necessarily lift and shift and drop it into Wales, but are there things that we could say, well, is there a way of doing this that would feel culturally appropriate for us here?
Yeah, when people ask me this question, I invite them to visit participedia.net. So it's a Wikipedia-like website that tracks participatory democracy practices around the world. So I looked at it this morning. There's currently, let me just look it up, 185 different countries on this website with 2,400 case studies and over 300 different methods. But they all have this common of how do you help people contribute to decisions that matter to them? So in specific examples, these are things that range from the forum theater in Brazil. So using theater to explore the lived experience of how policy is put into practice and asking people to deliberate on options. Another example I've been quite inspired by is the Conference on the Future of Europe. So this was the big effort by the EU a year ago or so. And that involved online citizen assembly models and an in-person citizen assembly model. But what they added to this process was they invited people to come back a year later and sort of review, well, how well did we do and what needs to be done? And that actually mobilized some accountability and some commitments by the EU in that work. It's still, if you talk to the organizers of it, of Deliberativia in Spain and some couple others, they're always a little bit like, oh, we could have done that better, but they provide some good groundwork. In BC, I'm still involved with a law reform project. So it is literally about how do we change a paragraph of this law to embed better public participation practices? So we have one model, we know it doesn't work. Do we institute a different rule-based model? So take out this game and add this game and here's the rules. Or do we shift it to what Victoria, Australia has done, which is a more principles-based local government act. So each local authority has to create their own public policy and it has to meet these five principles. And you do that. So there's another example of it actually being embedded in law. I also think Scotland's Community Empowerment Act is also something that is a role model in terms of people think of it that it's just about planning or law or the rights of a community to, have first rights of a certain property. I'm not an expert in it, so if I have explained it incorrectly, please tell me.
I'll pick up on that in a minute.
Yeah, but what I like about it is that, you know, similar to the Future Generations Act, its implementation of it has opened the world for participatory budgeting in terms of giving mechanisms and a way that invites these mechanisms to be practiced widely. It also leans on the strength of their community organizations to push these legislations in practice. So I think that's, you know, places where it has. And then, you know, the Wales we want as a national conversation, that also, you know, was a fabulous example of something that we're doing here. I do think there's the space where the work Anwen's doing is around this gap between we have these activities that become part of consultation processes. There's folks in the UK who are leaders in this. Involve UK as an example, folks who run citizen assemblies, the PB practice. But it's about how do you make those processes, how do we help the government be accountable to those processes? Because where this erosion of trust happens is when people show up and they do the work and they have the hard conversation and they get to some recommendations, and then it disappears from the public eye as it works through the public service. And the public service does their due diligence. They do their research, they do their analysis, and then it goes into the stage of deliberation with their elected officials. And that takes time, but from the public's perspective, they're like, oh, they didn't listen to me. That's really what we got to figure out, to help to draw those links and shorten that period of time.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think, you know, two things I want to pick up on there before we have a short break. One is the Scottish Community Empowerment Act, absolutely. And that's something that we at the IWA have been working on in relation to Wales for quite some time now. And then the other thing is around participatory budgeting, or PB. You know, the irony being that it's absolutely not new. It's been around, you know, decades. Mm-hmm. I remember my first returning to Wales job in 2004, there was one project that was looking at PB on the use of sports centres from a gender perspective in terms of impact. But how do you get that into the bloodstream of how things work in a way that is both meaningful and visible as well? So let's come back to the commission in a minute, but we're just going to take a short break now. Thank you both. Great. Welcome back. We are with Anwen Elias and Jen Wallowick from Aberystwyth University. And we're going to pick up Anwen on the Independent Commission and its work, and just talk a little bit about how processes of renewal, democratic renewal, have been part of those conversations for you as a commissioner. You know, thinking through the barriers to a more deliberative political process, and whether you see, you know, we've got a raft of electoral reforms coming up over the next little while. If you could just sort of talk people through those electoral reforms, and in nice, accessible, non-constitution speak, please, I think, which would be great. And whether those reforms take us closer or further away from that ideal, you know, in a way that people are part of those conversations and can see their input making a difference.
Okay, I will try my best. So the theme of democratic renewal, if you like, has come through the conversations, really from citizens themselves, because as I mentioned earlier, one of the themes is really that, you know, we don't really feel inspired to engage with Welsh democracy. These politicians, you know, what do they care what I think? And, you know, whatever I think doesn't change anything anyway. So that kind of message has put democratic renewal on our agenda as a commission. And it's part of thinking about how do we create a future Welsh society which is not just governed possibly differently, but also which is more lively, energetic in terms of its democracy. So that is a theme that is coming through. And as part of that, we have been thinking very much about how could we engage citizens differently in Welsh democracy. And part of that is, as you mentioned, thinking about electoral reform. Although I should say we haven't spent a lot of time thinking about electoral reform because a lot of work has already been done on that. We're expecting those legislative proposals to come forward from the Welsh Government. So just to summarise, you know, what the kinds of reforms that we're expecting there, we're expecting proposals to increase the size of the Senedd from 60 members to 96. We're expecting proposals to change the kind of electoral system that's used to elect those representatives. And that's expected to be a proportional representation system. And there are some proposals then around making the representatives that get elected to the Senedd more diverse. So, for example, through using quotas, gender quotas, for example, so that we have a better gender mix in our Senedd. So some of those reforms are on the way. What I would say is that they're important, absolutely, and they've been very much framed as proposals that are aiming to address the democratic deficit in Wales. But I would just caution against just seeing those as really the only way in which we will invigorate democracy in Wales. Of course, elections are important. They are the main way in which our kind of democracy is structured. But I'm also interested in what happens in between elections. And that goes back to some of the things that we've been talking about around engaging citizens, you know, throughout the electoral cycle, and not only thinking about, you know, democratic renewal in terms of, well, how can we make people more likely to vote in elections? And I think that's where there is a lot more to be done in terms of participatory and deliberative approaches to democracy, that citizen engagement becomes something that we think about and try to do all of the time, whether that be in terms of broad political debate or more specifically around policy consultation, policy development, policy implementation. So I would like to see us in Wales being more ambitious when we think about democratic renewal. Yes, of course, let's think about elections, but let's not stop there, because that only happens once every 4 or 5 years for the Senedd. What about the time in between? And actually, I think thinking about citizen engagement in those in-between times would also have a really big impact on turnout in elections, just generally by having citizens who feel more valued, who feel they have a chance to contribute through different mechanisms throughout the electoral cycle, then the evidence suggests that you have citizens who are more informed, more engaged, and that will feed through then into elections and turnout. So let's think a little bit more ambitiously and holistically about what democratic renewal could be.
Because it could be that sort of incentive, the engagement could be at any level, couldn't it? It could be in your local school PTFA, it could be in your local community, your local church or faith environment, whatever that may be. There's lots of work to be done, we know, in terms of towns and community councils across Wales as well. And I know that there is a piece of work looking at that process at the moment, let alone local authority elections too. So, you know, Senedd elections aren't the only game in town by any means, but they're still woefully low in turnout in relation to, you know, general elections. So, you know, what, 46 point something percent, I think it was last time around in 2021. Can we just pick up on Jen's comment about collages earlier on? And when some of your, I mean, lots of us haven't done a collage since we were at primary school, and I'd hold my hand up to that, but your work explores lots of non-verbal ways of deliberation using those sorts of creative approaches. Can you just talk us through what does talking about constitutional issues through collaging, how does that work, and how can that improve deliberation? And then can you show me where the Pritt stick is, please?
So this has been one of my more bonkers research projects. More bonkers than usual, but also absolutely one of the most enjoyable projects I've done. So typically, deliberative projects are based around talking and arguing and debating and deliberating through kind of spoken communication. And we know that that is valuable and can lead to kind of important outcomes and so on. But there are some political issues which also maybe are not so easy to talk about using words, maybe because they inspire a lot of emotion or a more visceral response. And for some people, talking is quite difficult sometimes, mm-hmm. and maybe people can express themselves more easily or differently through creative means. So that was my starting hypothesis, if you like. What would happen if we asked people to talk about, you know, a complex issue like constitutional change using a creative method? And collage making was the method that we ended up using. And so what we have done is we've run a series of workshops with community groups mostly in Newport in South Wales, where we asked them to make a collage. We didn't ask them to make a collage about, you know, Wales's constitutional future, because they would have left the room immediately.
Pretty sharp, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Rather, we, again, it comes back to the point of how do you phrase these things. Mm-hmm. So we asked them to make a collage on the Wales they lived in and the Wales that they would like to live in. And so we got them making collages, so cutting out pictures and words from magazines and newspapers, representing their experience of Wales. And then through the facilitation and the discussion, we would then take the conversation to explore the constitutional dimensions of the issues that they were bringing up in their collage. So, for example, somebody would select pictures or images around the NHS, doctors, because I'm frustrated, you know, I'm on a waiting list and I can't get my operation. So then the conversation that we would try to have would be, well, you know, that is something that is responsibility of the Welsh government. Do you think that is the right place for that decision to be taken? Who else could take that decision? So to steer the conversation from people's lived experiences of what matters to them, to probe some of the constitutional dimensions of those things. Against expectations, really, we got some incredible conversations about Wales's constitutional future through collage making, and a series of incredible collages that underpin hours of deliberation around these quite complex governance questions. And to me, it just showed the potential of creative methods just to start conversations in a different way.
I know,
to make issues accessible.
I know you presented those collages at an event that we held back in November. Are they also available for people to view online anywhere?
They are. They are on the Centre for Welsh Politics and Society website. There is a project there called Constitutional Futures. But the next stage of the project for me is I would like to take these collages and exhibit them places, because in terms of thinking about how we scale up deliberation, one thing is to do it with particular groups in particular settings. But I'm really interested in the idea of having these creative outputs, exhibiting them as a way of actually getting more people to look at the collages, to engage with them, and to think about the same issues that come through those collages. So you're asking a question there, which potentially for me is the next stage of research. You know, how can we scale up this kind of deliberation to bring in more people, to engage different kinds of communities in different places, and to do it differently?
There's something in that, which sounds great. I mean, there's something in that experience that means that the people involved in it go away with something, right? And go away feeling that they have explored an issue. And then also that, you know, the facilitators also can see what might work and what might work again in a different situation. But how we connect those processes with decision-making is the key challenge, isn't it? And that seems, you know, there's some pitfalls to negotiate. Jen, you talked about this a little bit earlier. How do we fill that gap? Because there's quite a lot of either really detailed working through kind of institutional bodies that are connected to either a parliament or a government, and, you know, kind of very step one is this, step two is this, and it must come back. But that feels like it needs quite a lot of machinery around it to make it happen, which takes time and dialogue as well to get to that stage. Are there other ways in which those deliberative processes can either hook onto or feed into that decision making in a way that is more run-of-the-mill sounds ordinary, but just kind of normal?
Yeah, and even that requires a bit of dialogue before that. So one of the things I love about this project that Anna's done is that it's entering into the space of why facilitation works. What happens when you give people an object to play with as they talk, or when you take a group and you give them pens and a notepad and they're actually drawing and like, you know, the note taker at the front of the room, it changes the dynamics of the conversation. And so our first step is actually to value that as much as some more traditional structures of, you know, what is happening in that Senate chamber, giving my speech, taking questions, the open question hour, to actually understand that creating space for people to be people is valuable. So a facilitator will open a room every time with an icebreaker, and we go, oh, it's an icebreaker, it's kind of annoying. It actually is a really good skill. So it is actually helping people invite their whole selves into the space. It actually gets people opening their mouths as soon as possible. It's sort of a facilitation rule. Get everyone talking as soon as possible, because it's more likely then the quiet people will offer things later on. It also, you know, reminds us to put ourselves in the shoes of others. So, and then for the facilitator, it's also mentally mapping, what are the undercurrents in this conversation? Who's showing up with what on their mind? So even in those first 5 minutes, whenever you're in a meeting and they're like, you know, tell us something happy that happened to you the last 3 days, it's actually a really valuable and democratic process. And so I think we have some education and training to do around what is a facilitated conversation, what is a deliberative conversation. So Aberystwyth, last week, we put 10 of our faculty through a facilitation course and 10 of our staff. And we have a waiting list for more to be like, what are these structures inside of a workshop that make workshops work? And so there's an education piece to it first. There's a piece here also where I think the IWA, we should keep having conversations around compensating participation. Even in my new entry here, I'm hearing the people recognize being invited to a workshop is work. Their experience is knowledge that should be valued, and they should have some form of compensation. Our current mechanisms of government, there is the time banking and there are some other things, but our accounting systems don't yet know how to do that math. And so there's work there. We need to figure this out because it's becoming a practice around the world. And so there's a piece there we have to mechanize, because if we pay people for participation, there's ethics around that. There's, you know, power dynamics in that conversation. We've got to spend time unpacking that, because we don't want to pay people to vote necessarily. That feels ethically, I don't know, not something that's democratic. But, you know, other countries say it's required because it's a sense of value. And so to get back to your question, kind of like, how do we do this? I think we've got some steps to figure out first, and we've got some more listening or dialogue to do.
Yeah, and that's interesting. So you're getting me thinking about a few things, but definitely that thing of, you know, the people in the room, they're people first before you do anything together. And I think often we kind of, right, we're here to do this. Boom, let's go straight to the purpose of the meeting. I'm a big believer in who are you today? Where are you at? And what are you bringing? What are you bringing to the table? There's also a role here for political leadership in this space, which is really tricky, I think. And it's also tricky when you've got lots of kind of contested opportunities, haven't you, around, you know, over the next little while. Anwen, you know, can I ask you to comment on that kind of political leadership piece? Because it doesn't only need to come from the top, does it?
No, it doesn't. But it's also helpful if it comes from the top. I think this is a tricky one, because if you ask, you know, politicians at whatever level, you know, do you think it's important that citizens are more involved in politics? Yes. If you ask them, however, really to embrace some of these deliberative participatory approaches and really take those on board and allow them to meaningfully feed into decision making, it requires politicians to cede power. That is, you are opening up to others to have a say in policy priorities or ideas for policy making. And that's quite difficult, in, not that they maybe would ever admit that, but that's often quite difficult for politicians. And that is often where you know, things like citizens' assemblies break down, is precisely when they go from the recommendations into the political arena, where there is no requirement on politicians or political parties to act on those recommendations. You know, quite often there are different dynamics, different considerations there that come into play that usually often mean that, you know, those deliberative recommendations actually don't go anywhere. So I think there is a political culture that has to change here around, you know, who has a legitimate voice in decision making. And if you're really serious about embracing deliberative and participatory approaches, that requires you to accept that, you know, as a politician, as a political party, I may be required to actually not take the final, to have the final say, or not only take decisions in these traditional political arena. And that's tricky, I think. So how do we kind of overcome that? Political education of our political leaders, perhaps, looking at examples of how this has been done elsewhere. Looking at how these innovations can be institutionalized, so kind of really integrating them into decision making at all kinds of different levels. But it does require political leadership and a willingness really to embrace this idea of doing democracy differently.
At the risk of being provocative, do you think this is a bit of a gendered thing too? Do you think women are better at having these deliberations because they kind of want to make, they want to kind of make sure that we're getting to an outcome that is, that as many people as possible are comfortable with and feel that they've engaged in? I mean, I think some of the debate, kind of the sort of, you know, the headbutting of political debate can be often characterized as very male, whereas women may potentially want to listen to, this is a massive sweeping generalization, so I hold my hands up for that. But I'm conscious of, we're three women talking about this, today, and often power is, and the political culture is conceived in a very male dominated way rather than a female dominated way. And some of how, you know, women can be accused of being, women politicians in particular can be accused of being soft because they are prepared to listen or perceived to be prepared to listen more. And we've got issues around political leadership. What does good political leadership look like? You know, we've, you know, there's been a lot of you know, praise, for instance, for Jacinda Ardern's leadership in this space in terms of empathic and kind, as well as clear, regardless of what you may think about her policies. So I'm just wondering if there's something here around, you know, when it comes to power, how you use the power that you have is not necessarily all about, it's not a zero-sum game, is it? It's also about sometimes when you're in a meeting, you don't have to necessarily be the one that has the answer, with a capital T for the answer. It could also be about spotting what's going on or saying, actually, I think Jen's got something really interesting to say. Jen, I'd like to hear from you. How you use that power, and how comfortable our politicians in Wales are in operating in that way. I mean, I can think of some that would be, you know, all over that, like a rash, and others who would just, it would just really be uncomfortable.
I'll tell you a story of when I visited in October and we were thinking of moving here, and I encountered a young woman and I was explaining dialogue and what the dialogue center could be. And she looked at me and she said, "Well, that seems really feminine. How do you think you're going to get anything done?" And it took me a pause, and then I was like, well, maybe we need a little bit more feminine thinking in the world. And we can lean into that a little bit. But I've also, you know, men who have the confidence to say, I don't know yet, tell me more, tend to be leaders that we gravitate towards. And those, you know, folks who intentionally seek curiosity before they judge, I think that's a masculine trait as well as a feminine trait.
I'd like to think so. I'm going to be watching. It's going to be one of my markers for people going into the next general election as well as the next Senate election. So thank you for that, Jen. I'll have a little tally chart at the back of my notebook. I think we've got time for one quick final question. So we can conceive of notions of dialogue and deliberations in that very systemic way. And we've talked about that today in terms of what that might mean. But Jen, you've also described it as a personal characteristic and a value or a skill. So what would you encourage everyone to take from your work into their lives, both professional and personal?
So we've talked about one just now. The second I would say is having a mindset of asking questions. So when I encounter an opinion that makes me sort of pause or I can feel myself disagreeing with, I give myself a rule of ask a question before I give my judgment. And then sometimes I ask two. And then I think about that. And then the third, which I think is a wonderful Welsh quality, is they introduced me to this word, adnabod, which is a form of knowing. It's a knowing that's deep familiarity. You adnabod your sons or daughters, your hometown. Dialogue is about seeking that familiarity before you enter judgment. So those are some of the ways in which we can personally practice it. And then I also give people permission to recognize it's a practice, and I'm not always very good at it. So as long as we keep practicing.
Nobody's perfect, Jen. Thank you very much indeed. Anwen, just in terms of, there's still opportunities for people to engage with the Independent Commission, aren't there, at the moment? If you could just outline what they are, please, that'd be great, and then we'll wrap up.
Yes, indeed. So there is an online interactive platform that you can look at. There is some information there about the Commission, but also about what some of these constitutional questions are, because people have asked for information just to help them think through what they think. There are opportunities there to have your say. There are surveys, there are various events that we host on there. I have been told that I am soon doing a Facebook Live event, which will be a first for me. We'll be at the Royal Welsh, at the Eisteddfod in August. So still lots of opportunities to talk to us, and we really are still very much open to hearing the views of people from across Wales. It's really the central strand of our work. So yes, absolutely. Do come and find us or ask us to come to you if that's what would work.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Radian, Anwen Elias and Jen Woolerwick from Aberystwyth University. Thank you.
You're welcome.